All right, once again, my name is Rabbi Ari Zucker. Very, very nice to meet you.
Ari Zucker?
Yes.
Thank you.
That's what my mommy calls me.
Okay.
We find ourselves at the precipice of the new year. Rosh Hashanah is right around the corner. Last night, my wife and I were discussing what the menu is going to be on Sunday night. And once you get to menu discussions, you know it's close. It's really happening, and we're about to spend a lot of time praying, a lot of time doing mitzvot, and really Tishrei the whole month from the start of the new year, Rosh Hashanah. We've got Yom Kippur, and then Sukkot, and Shemini Atzeret, Simchas Torah. It's a whole festive time. And even though the focus of the first 10 days of Tishrei are on tshuva, tshuva is really a theme that spans throughout the whole time period. You could do tshuva in a lot of capacities until Hoshana Rabbah, sort of halfway, almost toward the end of Sukkot. And so I was hoping that today we could discuss tshuva and a few components of it, try to get a better understanding of what tshuva is all about. And the question that I've been thinking about for a long time, for a while now, is can we change? Is change really possible? And so I'll open up the floor. We're amongst friends. You guys have seen a lot. You've got lots of wonderful life experiences. And in your years on this earth, do you think that people can change? No. I'm getting a strong no. Any yeses?
I say yes.
Yes.
All right, maybe you guys can fight it out for a little bit.
I don't want to fight it. Each of us is the way I feel.
Okay. Fair enough. So, what you might find interesting is that I explore this psychologically and I explored it rabbinically in our Torah sources. I have a degree in psychology, not a real degree. I have a bachelor's, and a bachelor's degree in psychology means that you don't really know anything about psychology. That's not entirely true, though. A friend of mine who's now, I think this year he's actually a doctor. He's a real psychologist. He would often comment, because a lot of young rabbis in Yeshiva University who want to go into the pulpit, they want to go into the rabbinate to some extent, they'll study psychology. Because, oh, I'll learn psychology, I'll know how to interact with people, I'll understand them better. And he would say, that's a terrible idea. Do not do that. They called it psych for smicha. That's like the cute line they used. Someone's studying psychology because they're going to be a rabbi. And he says, if you're planning on getting a bachelor's degree in psychology, a brief survey of these ideas, do not think that you know enough about psychology to actually use it. You need clinical training. You need someone who has actually seen it. You need hands-on experience. You can't just think about these ideas. You have to put it into practice. A similar idea exists in Torah. I was learning this past week. Rav Kook, the first chief rabbi of Israel, first Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Israel, talks about this is totally unrelated, but it's important. Says that Moshe, the Torah tells us that Moshe used to judge the Jewish people from morning till night. That's a very long time to judge someone. And he says the Torah didn't mean that Moses was judging people from literally break of dawn until the sun set. What it means is that he's judging, but the collective of his day was spent around preparing for that judgment. When Moses would learn Torah himself, it was in preparation of preparing himself to be someone that can judge the people. Everything he did was for the sake of the people, even though he wasn't literally sitting with his robe and the white hair and the gavel all day, every day. And Cook extends it and says, anytime someone's learning Torah, and I guess in the same sense in psychology, it's got to be practical. You got to be able to take it and make it real. And Torah that doesn't lead to a practical realization, a practical influence, is not as valuable, not as meaningful. And so God willing, today and throughout the whole year, we're going to try and make it practical and realistic. But along those lines, my degree in psychology was entirely ideological. It was entirely theoretical. I have no real practice in psychology. Someone called me yesterday with some problems, but that's just a friend. That doesn't count. And so the only thing I'm really licensed or qualified to do is to talk about psychological studies. And so psychologically, there's an approach to can we change? And in a Torah sense, there's an approach. And naturally, in a Torah sense, it's a machlokas. It's an argument. There's never, ever a clear consensus when it comes to Jewish thought. Someone disagrees with somebody about everything. And psychologically, it's also, to some extent, a machloket, it's also a disagreement. So we're going to look at a couple Torah sources. We'll tie some psychological ideas in as well. But on the notion of can I change or can I not change, the Gemara Rosh Hashanah says something that seems to suggest that I should be changing. Because it says that in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, that on Rosh Hashanah you've got three books. There are three books that are open. One of these books is for the entirely righteous people. One of these books is for the entirely wicked people. And one of these books is for those in-betweeners. I like to think of myself as an in-betweener. I'm a middle child. And I think in terms of, I don't think I'm entirely wicked. I'm certainly not entirely righteous, so I must be an in-betweener when it comes to my religious life as well. And so Gemara says that for the entirely righteous people, the tzaddik and gemurim, their fate is sealed immediately. For the entirely wicked people, immediately. But for those in between, they have between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur to get their act together, if you will, until they'll be ready for a clear decision, so where they can be stamped either in the Book of Life or, God forbid, the opposite. And so based on this Gemara, it sounds like there's an expectation that Sunday night, Monday, Tuesday, if I'm not up to par, I'm not a complete tzaddik, or God forbid the opposite, then I've got a week to change, to better myself in some capacity so that I can get to the point where I'm deserving of being sealed in the Book of Life. So I've got a week to change. That's not so much time. And so psychologically, there's discussion about can someone change? And effectively, the answer is yes and no. It's always yes and no.
Really?
Yeah. Welcome, come on in. Our chairs are a little... I think we can make space.
I guess they had
exercise. And so psychologically, we talk about two different kinds of change. There's change in a person's personality. We talk about there are five big personality traits that a person has. And there's a change in temperament. And who you are fundamentally can change. It is possible, according to many psychologists, that this could change. However, that takes a very long time. Years and years of work and development are required in order for someone to really change. But on a short term, you could make minor adjustments. You could, through being more thoughtful and more active in your day, to be mindful is the popular term, you could go from someone who's a little bit aggressive and being more soft-spoken. You could go from being less patient to being more patient. Those are all possible. Those are short-lived. They don't last forever. You haven't really changed. You're acting differently, which is fine, but you haven't changed. If I want to be sealed in the Book of Life, I feel like I got to change for real, but that change takes a long time. So now what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to arrive at real change in such a short period of time? And it gets even worse, because the Rambam, Maimonides, 12th century rabbi who wrote a ton of Jewish law, but what's fascinating is that on the one hand, he was all about law and order. On the other hand, he was a philosopher. And in Hilchot Tshuva, in his laws of tshuva, of repentance, he kind of combines the two, because it's written in law form. A person should do this, they shouldn't do that. But it's deeply philosophical. And so philosophers will look at this law book of his because it's fascinating. And it's got 10 chapters, and it's beautiful, and it's insightful. And each one has different ways of looking at things. And he says something that we might find interesting.
What is the name of the book?
This is Rambam in Hilchos. He says, "Midarkei tshuva. What are the ways that someone can do tshuva? All right, I want to do tshuva. I'm ready. It's Rosh Hashanah time. It's Yom Kippur. I want to be better. What do I do?" And he says very simply, "Soeg tamid lifnei Hashem." You should yell out. You should scream constantly before God about. And plead, "I want to be better, help me be better." You should give tzedakah, you should give charity. That makes sense. All right, we're praying, we're giving charity. If you're sinning in a certain area, you should probably stop doing that. You can't ask for forgiveness for something that you're actively doing.
Oh.
Okay, fine. All three of these make sense. And then he says, umishanishmo, and someone should change their name. What does that mean? Don't worry, he tells us. He says, klomar. Ani acher v'eni oto ha'ish, sh'asa oto ha'maisim. I am a different person. I'm unrecognizable. That means that the obligation of tshuva upon all of us is that we have to become new people. So the next time I come in here, it will be after Rosh Hashanah, it will be after Yom Kippur, and I should be a different person, unrecognizable. And you should say, oh, there's a new rabbi in the kollel. I'm supposed to become someone totally new. But how am I supposed to do that? That's a tall order. And so we need to figure that out. We got to explore. And on the one hand, I need to change. And in the Pakhan Yitzchak, Rav Yitzchak Kuttner says that change, this is beautiful, is the single greatest capacity of humans. When we talk about angels, you know, for people who pray in the Amida, this is often a shul. You stand with your feet together, your 2 feet together, and we say we're like angels. Why? Because angels only have one leg. So biologically, how that works, I don't think is really up for discussion. I don't think that what we're being told is that biologically an angel has one leg where I have two. It's in a sense an angel is a messenger of God. An angel has one job, one task to do. The angel accomplishes their task and then they're done. What that means is that angels don't move. Angels don't mission. They accomplish the mission. Zehu. Whereas a person is in this world, God willing, for many, many decades, and they'll do a lot of things. They've got 2 feet. They'll move. Kabbalistically, we say that you know shamayim, which means sky, the heavens, is sham. It's there. Whereas aretz is from the language of ratz, which means to run. In contrast, shamayim to aretz, sky and the ground is a place where people are supposed to move. We're never supposed to be stopped. And so when we talk about praying for life versus death, we talk about praying for a year of chayim in Rosh Hashanah. It's not just that we're hoping to have another birthday this year. We're hoping for a year of real life where we'll be able to move, where we'll be able to run and fulfill our purpose on this world of a place of movement. It all takes steps forward because angels can't do that. It's a uniquely human capacity. And Rav Huttner says that the greatest human ability is to do tshuva, is to change yourself. And so that's a wonderful opportunity. But we've got another Gemara, Masechet Shabbos, that seems to disagree, that seems to tell me that it's not so possible. We'll go line by line. It's fascinating stuff. How many of us read horoscopes? I don't read horoscopes. But the notion of a horoscope is that someone's born at a certain time of year under certain stars, and that's going to influence their personality. And you'll have some people, my wife is telling me about this at work, that some people will be like, oh, you're such a Virgo. Or you're totally an Aries. I don't know what those personalities look like. I don't know how they act. But there's this notion that if you're born at certain times of the year, that's going to influence who you are and how you act. And that's seemingly not so consistent with Jewish values, except the Gemara at the end of the second Shabbat tells us that there is some element of astrology, even in Judaism. We call it mazalot. When we talk about someone's mazel, as we say mazel tov, it's that you should have good luck, you should have good, it should be auspicious. And so there's a level of astrology, even in Judaism. And so the Gemara tells us, somebody born under the sun is going to be a radiant person, which makes sense, because the sun radiates. So I would radiate. If I'm a sun person, I will radiate. And what does it mean to radiate? I'll drink from my own resources, I'll eat from my own resources. I'm going to be self-promoting. I'm going to be able to sustain myself, just like the sun sets off its own light. But all of my actions will be publicized. If I do something wrong, if I steal, I'll be caught. Because as the sun, I radiate light. I'm in public. Everything about me is visible. Okay. And then we contrast it. If someone's born under the moon, then they will only be a reflection. The moon doesn't have its own light. The moon is just an awesome mirror and reflects off the sun. And so someone who's born under the moon will not eat of their own food. They will not drink their own resources. They will need to be a receiver, just like the moon is a receiver. But just like the moon's a receiver, the moon's also hidden. And so if someone does something as a moon personality, It's going to be hidden. If someone steals, they won't be caught. That's the sun and the moon. And then we go on. We talk about Venus. And Venus is where fire comes from, apparently. So you'll be rich, but you'll also be somewhat promiscuous, because it takes a flame to really to get money together, to become wealthy. But there's also a promiscuity involved in fire. And Mercury is closest to the sun, closest to the light. A Mercury person will be insightful. And so we go through this whole list. And it would seem that as much as I'm supposed to change who I am, supposed to change my name, how much choice do I really have? What are my options here? I'm a sun person. I'm always going to be a sun person. So at the very end of the Gemara is the most popular. It says someone who's born under Mars will be a bloody person. What does it mean to be a bloody person? Well, there are a lot of options. If someone's a bloody person, they might be a thief. They might be a warrior. They also might be a shohet. They might be a ritual slaughterer. They also might be a moel.
Could be a hemophilia.
There's a lot of options. And so Rav Ashi, you know, gets this whole list. Rav Ashi says, you know, if you're going to be a bloody person, then there are all these things that you could be doing. And Rabba says, whoa, back up. I don't commit to this notion that I have any sort of predestiny. I don't believe that there's anything about me that's out of my hands, because I am born under Mars. My birthday was last week, apparently, maybe. And he says, I was not a shochet, I was not a moel, I wasn't a warrior, and I wasn't a thief. So your whole theory is out the window with me. And Abaye, who is Rabba's student, says, Rebbe, Bechavu, with all due respect, I don't know that you're right. Because even though you didn't kill people in the traditional sense, even though you didn't kill animals in the traditional sense, you were on a court. You were on a Beit Din. And as a Beit Din, a member of the Beit Din, you sentenced people to death. And so to some extent, you were all as bloody as well. You have not escaped your mazel. And so if even Rabba, who didn't feel that he fit into any of these things, is stuck in this notion of being bloody, then if I've got certain flaws about me, what hope do I have to develop, to change? I seem to be stuck. And particularly if I only have a week to do it, how do I have any hope of getting better? And so, the Maggid of Mezrich, who is the second Hasidic Rebbe, shares a beautiful Torah. Maggid of Mezrich, as a personality, was fascinating. He was in a wheelchair his whole life. And it seems that whatever he lacked in physical ability, in his mind, it was just traveling nonstop. The Maggid of Mezrich has beautiful mashalim, beautiful parables, and was the leader of the Hasidic movement. And so the first one, the Baal Shem Tov, he started something off. But the person who takes the ropes the second time around and is able to pass that on to the third is oftentimes the most crucial. A lot of things start out. There's a lot of excitement in the beginning, and so the Baal Shem Tov could have started a movement. Similarly, Avram Avinu could have started monotheism. But the next person is of great significance, because you need the Maggid of Mezrich, just like you need a Yitzchak, to take over. And what's so special about Yitzchak and about the Maggid of Mezrich is that they're the ones who maintain the consistency. They're the ones who took this spark and made it sustain and last. Why we have Hasidut around the world today. Why even for people who see them, they're deeply influenced, as is anyone who's ever been to a Karlbach minyan. 300 years ago, most people who were not Hasidim were never ever going to daven Karlbach or anything of the sort. But the Jewish world has been deeply influenced by Hasidut, and part of that is thanks to the Maggid of Mezrich. Maggid of Mezrich has a beautiful, beautiful insight. He says, the Gemara tells us, Yesh kona olamo b'sha'a achat. We're not going to go through that whole story about Rabbi Elazar ben Dordai at this moment, but that one can acquire their world in just 1 hour. A sha'a is an hour. He says, hold on. Sha'a does not always mean hour. I'll take you also a few weeks forward, to Parashat Bereishit, to the beginning of time, where you have two brothers, Cain and Hevel, and Cain and Hevel both offer a sacrifice to God. But Cain has a problem, because the Torah tells us, to the offering of Cain, which was not as nice, it was not his best fruits, it was his worst fruits, it was the scraps that he offered to God, as opposed to Hevel's first, you know, best sheep. It says God did not turn to Cain's offering, but the language of the Torah is that God did not sha'ah. He didn't. The language is sha'ah. Sha'ah does not just mean hour, does not just mean time. It means to turn in another context. And so the Maggid of Medrash says, what if the Gemara is not telling us that someone can acquire their role to come? Someone can become the best version of themselves in just 1 hour? Because that seems impossible. Psychology tells us it's impossible. It just, logically, it doesn't seem to fit. So what's that one sha'ah that I can change who I am? Maybe it's a turn instead. Maybe it's just a shift. My Rebbe used to tell us, my brother and I, growing up, were very similar, and then we took different paths, and to be honest, we're still very similar, but externally our lives look very, very different. And so he used to tell me more than once, that if someone's shooting an arrow and they're pointing it in front of them, it's going to go straight down for hundreds of yards. If they turn just a little bit, it might not even be noticeable to someone standing next to the archer. But when you get 100, 200, 300 yards down, the arrows are very, very far apart. The trajectory that someone's on might just require a tiny shift, a tiny turn. And that'll have a massive difference going forward. And so why does that matter? Why do I just need a small turn? Because yes, there might be things born in me. I might naturally be born under Mars. It might be bloody. But if I can shift that use of my bloody nature from the negative to the positive, if I can take it from even just someone who doesn't get grossed out by blood, and so, you know, recognizing, oh, you know, if I don't get grossed out by blood, and a lot of people do, then I can donate blood. My wife is a tzaddikess in many regards, but I make fun of her for this. She's blood type O negative, which I believe is like the best you could have, a universal donor. Very, very good. I'm AB positive, which I'm super exclusive. I'm only a receiver, and I cannot give to anyone. Well, I can give to other ABs. The world's big enough today that there are plenty of ABs who need. But so I donate blood on a whenever it's convenient, really. Whenever it comes to the shul or the school, I try to donate. My wife hates needles and hates blood, so she never donates. And so she's got a real tendency away from it. I don't think I'm such a bloody kind of person, but I have some sort of tendency, and I can use that and say, you know what, maybe I can donate blood. To a further sense, someone could make a massive shift. Someone could say, you know, if I have a tendency, I'm less sensitive, I'm less queasy around blood, I could become a shochet. In Yeshiva University, YU's been training rabbis for over 100 years. And so not so much today, but back in the day, we'll say 50 years ago, if you're going to be a rabbi in a small Jewish community, there might not be kosher food available. And so what needs to happen? You, as the rabbi, have to be able to shecht animals, at the very least, shecht chickens. Nowadays, we can move food really quickly. We got freezers. I've got a friend in Charleston. They don't have a kosher supermarket or a kosher butcher. So every 6 weeks, the meat comes in. And they bought an extra freezer when they got there. I think they have three freezers, actually. They have the meat one, which is like going to the store. And then they have the standard freezer and the extra. And so they think 6 weeks ahead, okay, what am I going to need? What meat am I going to need? So I guess like Tisha B'Av time, his wife was like thinking, okay, what am I going to need for the Chagim? Which is very scary. Actually, no, not Tisha B'Av. Maybe around the beginning of Elul, while some people are like, oh, we got plenty of time. In Charleston, they're thinking, well, we got to get the meat for Elul in the next couple of weeks or it's not going to come. And so part of rabbinic training used to be that you had to learn the laws of shechting, laws of ritual slaughter, and you also were supposed to do it so that you had experience. And so this is no longer part of the YU curriculum, and I don't know that I would have become a YU rabbi if it were. I'm not interested at all. But one of my colleagues, not really colleagues, someone who was there many, many years before me, I look up to him, he's a mentor of mine, tells a story about how when he was supposed to do it, they're all there, and he's looking at the chicken, and he tells the instructor, I don't think I can check this chicken. I don't think I have what it takes. And the guy says, don't worry about it. After the first one or two, it gets much, much easier. So my friend responds, I'm so glad that after one or two times, I'll be so jaded, so desensitized to killing another being that I'll be fine doing it. So I'm glad that I didn't have to do it, but there are people who are okay with it, who aren't going to be disturbed. Disturb my sister. We're coming up on Kapparot. We're coming up before Yom Kippur, and so either you could give money, which is the normative practice, I highly recommend everyone give money, or you can do it with the chicken, wave a chicken around your head, check the chicken, and then give the chicken to someone who doesn't have any food. It's a beautiful thing. Skip the chicken part and go straight to the food, to the money part. But they did a demonstration for us in middle school. I was in sixth grade, and my older sister was in eighth grade. They did a demonstration with a live chicken a couple days before Yom Kippur. And what do you know? Dahlia stopped eating meat for years because it was so disturbing. So for the Zookers, spilling blood. But for someone who's not going to be disturbed by it, it's not going to bother them, it's a tremendous mitzvah to provide kosher food to people. You can create Simchas Yontif. Someone to be a moel, I've got a friend who's a moel, and I could not do that either. Thank God I'm not queasy, but I cannot be a moel. But some people have that ability. And to be able to say, well, maybe I don't just need to be able to withstand blood, but I could use that in a godly sense. I can shift a little bit. Maybe that's the key. Because the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, this is amongst the most famous, most popular of Mishnayot from Ben Zoma. We talk about Ezu Chacham, who is wise? Someone who learns from every person. Beautiful. And who is rich? I heard this a lot growing up. I was one of five kids, and there was always jealousy amongst who got what. Who is rich? Someone who's happy with what they have. But the Mishnah also says, Ezehu Gibor, who is strong? Not someone who can lift hundreds of pounds. Hakovish es Yitzro, someone who conquers their Yetzer, their evil inclination, seemingly. And so I heard from Rabbi Reis, the Av Beit Din on the CRC, one of the big rabbis in our community, that Hakovish es Yitzro is very specific. It's Hakovish. It doesn't say Mevatel. You're conquering. You're not destroying. You're not nullifying. You are conquering. When you conquer something, if we Illinoisans decide that it's time to spread out, and we're going to take over, then all the Wisconsinians, that's probably not the way to pronounce it, all the people of Wisconsin will be the same people, same families, same houses, same everything, except now, when they pay taxes, they'll be paying taxes to Illinois, which we could use because our taxes are too high. And their license plates will say Illinois instead of Wisconsin. But effectively, they're the same thing. They're not changing who they are, just they're changing a focus a little bit. If that ever does end up happening, it was not my idea. I don't take no responsibility for any invading of any states in the nearby Midwest area. So I want to clarify that. But when you covage something, you conquer it, you're taking something and directing it toward something else. The goal is that we are able to conquer our inclinations, conquer who we are, take my midah, take my character trait, and direct it in a positive sense. That person is strong. And so it really, if we think about it, this whole time period, we talk about chet, we talk about sin. But sin, and that seems to be a very, very big focal point of this time, which, quite honestly, is a little bit uncomfortable. I don't like thinking about sin. I don't like thinking about how bad I am, how I don't do the right thing, how I do things, how I do the wrong. And so for me to get into this time period, to think about sin, it's not going to work for me. It's hard for me to spend so much time thinking about, all right, what'd you do wrong here, what'd you do wrong there? You're a sinner in this regard, a sinner in that regard. This generation generally has low self-esteem, and that definitely would not help. But what if sin is not the best way to translate chet? What if there's another way that we could translate chet? Because this is pointed out in a number of people, sources. The Meiri says it, the Malbim says it, and really Shmuel Hanavi says it. Because if you look at Sefer Shoftim, which is written by Shmuel Hanavi, it's describing the army of Binyamin. And the army, they're really impressive men, 26,000 fighting men. And of the 26,000, they picked the best 700. We've got the Marines of the tribe of Binyamin. And what was so great about these men? I'm going to read in Hebrew and then translate. Kol zeh kolea be'evin esa sa'ara v'lo yachata. Every one of these men, these marines, these elite soldiers from the tribe of Benjamin, was able to sling a stone at a hair and not yachata. What does yachata? What does yachata mean? Miss. What if chet does not mean sin in the dark, dreary, fire and brimstone sense, but chet means you missed? That the soldiers of Binyamin could throw a rock at a hare and not chata, and not miss. They were always accurate. When God forbid, we do something wrong, when maybe we're not sinning per se, but we're missing an opportunity. We're just missing the mark. The arrow didn't land where it was supposed to. And then think about it. You're having a conversation with your friends, and you're sitting around, and someone, God forbid, starts gossiping. They speak Lashon Hara. That is a tremendously lost opportunity. Eleanor Roosevelt said that I'm elaborating a little bit, but there are three kinds of people. Great people talk about ideas. Average people talk about events. And small people talk about other people. Talk about me, maybe. Talk about other people. If you're sitting around talking about other people, you could have been great. You could have discussed ideas, and you're talking about other people. You've chosen to be small. Yes, you were a chote. Now that you sinned, you missed the opportunity. You could have been great, and you missed that, out on that. And maybe not just in a Ben Adam L'Chaver context, not in a social context. Someone has the chance to keep Shabbos, to recognize that God created the world in 7 days and is actively running the world on a daily, moment-by-moment basis. You can keep Shabbos and you don't. We say that you were a chote. It's not that you did something wrong. It's that you missed the opportunity to recognize something incredible, to be partner in creation with God. That's awesome. That's a chet. That's a missed opportunity. And so if we just take I have all of these skills and abilities that God put in me, and I don't use them to the best of my ability, I take my inclination toward aggression, toward bloodiness, and I use it to hurt people instead of to help people, that's a chet. Not a chet because it's a sin, it's a chet because it's a missed opportunity. And so, growing up, my mother was very close with the Rebbetzin of our community, with the rabbi's wife. She was a tremendous tzaddikas. Her name was Shandy Feuerstein. She passed away a number of years ago. Her neshama should have an aliyah. And I missed out tremendously. I could have spent a lot more time with her, but I was young and stupid, and so I didn't. But still, even with the few times I did spend with her, there were a few gems that I was able to take away. And one wasn't even from hanging out with her, who was the sweetest, warmest, most genuine lady, in addition to being a tremendous scholar and a fantastic educator. But in her kitchen, she had a sign that I saw and it stuck with me till today. The sign said, "Your talents and abilities are God's gift to you. What you do with them are your gift to God." During this time of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, God's looking at the world and saying, "How are we doing? Do we have a lot of people who are chotim, who are not sinning, but a lot of people who are missing the mark? What can I be doing to get on the mark? What can I be doing to make sure that I'm on the right path?" I told the story last time I was here, but it's too good of a story to pass up, and some of us weren't here. But does anyone know the name Alfred Nobel? Alfred Nobel. Bell lived in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and he was a tremendous inventor. He was a chemist. And he had like 300-something inventions, one of which was particularly popular. He invented dynamite. He invented explosives, which weren't around beforehand. Very impressive, Alfred Nobel. And so Nobel had made a lot of money, naturally. This was a tremendous, tremendous tool, unfortunately also a tremendous weapon. And so when the year 1888 came around and Alfred's brother Ludwig passed away, an obituary was written for Mr. Nobel. However, the newspaper made a little bit of a mistake, and instead of thinking that Ludwig died, they thought Alfred had died. And so Alfred Nobel was able to read his own obituary. Oy. Terrible. Yeah. And in the obituary, what did it say? It said, the merchant of death has passed away. Alfred Nobel's gone. Thank God. Thank heavens that he's away, because he was responsible for so many people to die. And Alfred Nobel said, I'm not okay with that. I can't. That cannot be my legacy. And so Alfred Nobel said, made a ton of money through TNT, through my explosives, and I'm an inventor. I should invent something with my money, with my resources, with my abilities, with the things that are ingrained in me, with who I am, and I have to do something good. So Alfred Nobel invented the Nobel Prize, which is awarded to someone who has made a significant contribution to humanity. That's the charter. Everything else, all the other details, fall by the wayside. Nobel said, and now, since 1901, for most people, if you mention the name Nobel, they don't think of the person who invented dynamite. Most people don't know that. They don't think about someone who was responsible for death. They think of a prize that we laud, that we look up to, that we treasure. Someone gets a Nobel Prize. That's amazing. A couple of Nobel Prizes are a little bit fudged. But for the most part, Nobel Prizes are extraordinary. We're wrapping up in 30 seconds. Alfred Nobel did exactly what the Rambam tells us to do. Alfred Nobel looked and said, I'm no longer that person. I'm going to change my name. Literally, the name Nobel is no longer negative, and now it's positive. We all have that ability. Maybe not to the large extent as Alfred Nobel, but God willing, in the coming days and weeks of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we will take the character traits that are built in within us and direct them toward the positive, to be on a trajectory that, God willing, this time next year will all be unrecognizable. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day. Yeah, thank you.